Welcome back to the program. It's a good thing, I suppose, that issues of race and bias and the need for social justice are still very much a part of the work of some people. If you saw the GOP debate on Monday night, you know why that's still so important. You know, Bobby Kennedy used to say, in quoting George Bernard Shaw, that some men see things as they are and ask why. Others see things that never were and ask why not. It can be said that our guest this morning, Connie Rice, has shared that vision in the work that she's done in the areas of civil rights, on the mean streets of Los Angeles, and in improving the ways in which our society deals with its most damaged citizens. Connie Rice is the co-founder and co-director of the Advancement Project in Los Angeles. She's received more than 50 major awards for her leadership of diverse coalitions and her non-traditional approaches to litigating major cases. She serves on the board of the Public Policy Institute of California, as well as public radio station KPCC. She's a graduate of Harvard and the New York University Law School. She has led multiracial coalitions of lawyers and clients to win more than $10 billion in damages and, more important, policy changes. She's been named one of the 100 most powerful people in Southern California and has twice been named one of the top 10 most influential lawyers in California. It is my pleasure to welcome Connie Rice to the program today to talk about her new memoir, Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America, From the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. Connie Rice, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Delight to have you here. You know, one of the things that I think is particularly unique about your story is that there are so many people that have fought for civil rights in the courtroom and in litigation, and others that have worked on the streets of cities, and you have somehow bridged those two. You have somehow done both, dealt with the human side of what takes place on the streets of Los Angeles in particular, and also understanding what it takes in the courtroom and in the corridors of power. Talk about that balance.
Well, yes, I guess that's true. But I think all lawyers do it to some extent. I think I just took the street part of it, the non-court part of it, a little further. You know, when you win in court, that's a great thing. But that's often only the beginning. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, we are not going to find our future in the courtrooms. It's not going to happen in the courtrooms. They're important. The litigation is absolutely critical. Nothing would have moved without the major lawsuits. And litigation is still important. But what happens after you win a case is that the courts, especially now, because we've lost a lot of progressive judges, the bench is so conservative now, that the courts won't even order what law permits nowadays. And what we need to have happen, a court can't reach. So I decided, right after the riots in L.A., after the Rodney King trial, acquitted those officers and we had our big riot, I decided, okay, you know, you're not going to fix this in a courtroom. You better get out in the street and talk to people and ask them, what do you need us to do, which is what I did. And that's how I started my trek through gangland.
I mean, you tell the story of coming out of federal court dressed to the nines and, you know, and winding up at the mean streets of Watts.
Yes, I was before a Republican judge, and I've learned to dress the way that that if they like their wives, you dress the way their wives dress. And this particular judge likes St. John's suits. So I was in a St. John's suit and more pearls than Barbara Bush and Ferragamo pumps, if you can imagine, and tootled down to Watts in my beat-up Civic from court. And I went down there to meet Mercedes Marquez because I went down to Jordan Downs, which used to be an African-American housing project. It's now majority Latino, because there were Latino residents who were in trouble because the African-Americans, who had so little, did not want another group coming in. And so we went down there to kind of do some racial detente, interracial detente, Mercedes Marquez, another attorney, and I. And I met her down there, and we met at the gym. Some of the women of Jordan Downs had decided they wanted to talk to us as well. Long story short, we ended up getting cussed out, and rightly so, because these were women who were saying, look, you left us in this hellhole where the bullets fly through our houses at night because of the crack wars. We have to put our kids to sleep in bathtubs or make them sleep on the floor because it's so dangerous with the gunfire. And now you come down here and ask us to worry about another group. You need to help us. And so, you know, I said, okay, you're right. You're right to cuss us out. And I said, what do you want? Do you want us to leave or do you want me to help? And this one woman stood up and she said, please, the only thing we need is for the guns to stop. We're it's a war zone, and it's a killing field, and our kids are dying. We're not safe. Please go help our men with this gang truce that they're doing. And stupid me, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I said, what gang truce? So long story short, I end up going back to this trailer where these gangsters are negotiating how to carry out this ceasefire truce. They had the Bloods and the Crips. You had the Bounty Hunter Bloods and the Grape Street Crips. They were negotiating how to carry out this larger truce between their two gang sets. At the time, L.A. had about 400 gangs, and the Crips and the Bloods were among them. Now, L.A. has over 1,000 street gangs and over 100,000 gang members. So that was the beginning of my trek through gangland.
And part of this really addresses this disconnect between rights that may exist on the one hand, and you can pass all the laws you want to enforce those rights, and the reality of safety on the streets, the reality of what's taking place on the ground.
So important. I mean, one of the points of this book, they told me to write a memoir, and they said it has to be about your life. I said, I don't care about my life. I care about my work, and I care about the people I've served. And they kind of laughed. They said, Connie, you have to write about your life. So I said, okay, I'll throw a little bit of stuff in there about my family. But the real point of this book is that I have had the privilege of serving some incredible people, be they on death row, be they in the gang zones, be they cops and LAPD. I've had them all as clients, and even when they weren't clients, I've had them as allies. Even though we probably started out doing hand-to-hand combat, I always end up as allies with the people I fight. But this journey through gangland showed me how, with all the wins, I mean, I was winning all my cases. We're very good lawyers. I win every case. I was winning my cases, but my clients were losing their lives. And I said, what is wrong with this picture? If we lawyers think we're doing the right job, we send our clients back to shooting galleries, and we consider that a win. Yeah, we were winning the cases, but the laws weren't about the conditions that they faced. They weren't about the fact that there were more guns than there were loaves of bread in a neighborhood. It wasn't about the fact that kids couldn't walk to school safely. The police were, at the time, we were suing the police because they weren't serving the community. They were serving themselves, and they were brutal, and they were behaving in racist ways. And so the police were not an ally 20 years ago. They are an ally now, which is also part of this story, is how did we go from fighting tooth and nail as mortal enemies with the cops and then become their closest allies 25 years later. But this journey through gangland, I had to learn what my clients faced. And you can't learn what your clients face sitting in a law office or standing at a podium in a court. You've got to go on the ground. You've got to get on the buses. You've got to be in the hospitals at 2 o'clock in the morning after a gang shooting. You really have to be there to understand what your clients face. And that's what I decided to do. I had to leave the courtroom and go to the kill zones. And I call them the kill zones. They are the hottest of the gang zones, the most dangerous of the gang zones. When I talk about kill zones, I'm not talking about the whole ghetto or the whole barrio. I'm talking about square blocks that are so dangerous, the police would not allow me to go in them. They said, Connie, it's too dangerous for you. I said, it's too dangerous for me, a grown woman, but we've left children in these areas. They said, well, we can't help that, but we can't let you go in there because if you get shot, we'll get in trouble. But if a kid gets shot, it doesn't even make the news. That's what this book is about.
The other thing that you had to learn, and you learned it quickly, but it took you a lot longer to convince others, that the population that you were dealing with, specifically the men, were addicted to a certain kind of violence, and that this wasn't something that was going to turn around overnight, and that it had to be incremental.
I don't know that I've convinced anybody of anything, which I had. That's why I wrote the book, trying to get folks to understand that we've come a long, long way, but boy, do we have a long way to go. And while things are better for most of us, although with this recession, I'm not sure we're going to hold on, we're going to hang on. The working class and the lower middle class, I'm not sure they're going to make it. if we don't turn it around this year. Yes, we've come a long way, but this book is about the areas that never got touched by what King did, never got touched by what Thurgood Marshall did in the courts or what we've done in the courts. I'm talking about the America we've left behind in our ghettos, in our barrios, in our glens, in our hollers. I'm talking about Appalachia. The poorest of the poor, no matter what race they are, we've completely left them behind. We don't even count them anymore. They're not in our employment statistics. If you're homeless, you probably don't get counted in the census. So I'm talking about invisible America, the part of America that never got touched. And for black Americans in this echelon, in this cohort at the very bottom, they didn't even make it out of slavery. In fact, if you look at the data, the poorest of poor African Americans are as bad off or worse off than the slaves right out of slavery. Because you have mass incarceration, you have poverty that has never ended, you have 80% unemployment. These folks would love 20% unemployment. That would be an improvement. And we're quaking at 17% real unemployment in the middle class today. So that's the echelon that I'm talking about. And so I need to be very clear that I'm not saying we haven't made any progress. I'm not saying that the ghetto isn't better off. In fact, the book is about the 20 mm-hmm. years of progress and how at the end of that 20 years, I could tell those women in Jordan Downs, you know what? You don't have to put your grandkids to bed in a bathtub anymore. But your grandchildren can still be shot to death by a gang stopping them and asking them that dreaded question, where are you from? Because when a kid in South L.A. or the poorest parts of East L.A. gets stopped on the streets by a car full of young men who are members of that gang in that neighborhood, and you get asked that question, it means they're getting ready to shoot you. We just had a shooting last week in El Camino, probably not gang-related, but I can tell you of kids who get shot every month now. We don't count the tallies by week or by day like we used to during the crack wars. There was one weekend we had 17 drive-by shootings with 11 fatalities. That was just one weekend. We don't have those kinds of incidents anymore because we've improved it together with the community, with police who now actually view the community as an object of service rather than an object of terror. So we've really, really turned a lot of things around in L.A. with a lot of grassroots partners, a lot of good lawyers. But we've got a longer way to go because the problems have changed and we've never, ever touched the poorest parts of invisible L.A.
Talk a little bit about the mass incarceration strategy that went on for so long.
And it's still going on. In Jordan Downs, I estimated, remember, it's in the poorest, it's the poorest of the poor. I estimated over the 15 years that I would go down there pretty regularly that out of all those families, 1,000 families, I would say the real unemployment rate for the black men in those housing projects was somewhere between 50 and 70%. There were no jobs. Over 120,000 jobs left the South L.A. region, which is probably as big as Vermont. No, it's not quite that big. The city is probably as big as Vermont. But, you know, L.A. is so huge. It's over 500 square miles. The county is 4,000 square miles. We really are. People don't understand the scale of things out here. So when you have a housing project with this many folks in it, the impact on the South L.A. region is big from this housing project because it is huge. It's huge. Now, when I looked at this and I said, wait a minute, so people don't work. Remember William Julius Wilson writing When Work Disappears. That book was about communities like this. You have 4 and 5 generations in the housing projects, which is not good policy, who have never worked and aren't going to be able to work because the schools are so bad that everybody still remains functionally illiterate. If you stay in school, if it's even possible to stay in school, the schools are so bad that you can't learn. So you've got a petri dish of joblessness, a petri dish of unhealthy living. It's an ecosystem for death. And when you learn this ecosystem of death, you understand why the kids in particular families, we call them gang families because every member of the every generation is part of the particular gang in that neighborhood. And I linked up with a couple of these families just to learn the culture. And as you were suggesting, it's deeply entrenched. One kid I worked with for about 10 years, he's now doing life in federal prison. But he was a when he was out of prison, he would work very hard at keeping the truce going because he gained a new identity by doing peace. He said, "Yo, lady lawyer, you know, I'm not the predator. I'm not a predator anymore. I'm a peacemaker." And he was really proud of that arc that he had traveled from predator to peacemaker. And I remember walking the streets with him, and I know how he would enforce it. It was like a grapevine enforcement. It was very grassroots. It was very viral. And everybody had to sign on, not in writing, but with a pledge. And they would play basketball with one another. People who'd been slated to kill one another on rival gangs would be forced to play a basketball game at night, a midnight basketball. And people have heard about these things, mm-hmm. but at the time they were new. And at the time, it was all a community strategy, a gang community strategy, to stop the killing. And as I learned it, I mean, I learned how entrenched the gang culture was. And this one kid with whom I worked, he said, "Look, this is all I know. I ain't going to know anything else. And I'm going to die here. And I live and I die for my gang, Connie. You don't understand." And I told him, "No, I don't understand." And he said, "I'm not going anywhere." And I said, "But can't you think 10 years from now what you want to do? I can help you." And he said, "There ain't going to be no 10 years. I'll be dead in 5. And he basically said, "I'm either going to die in prison or I'm going to die on the street." That was his expectation. And for most of the kids from that kill zone, that was the reality.
In many ways, violence was the only way that they knew to express themselves.
It was the way to manhood. And I'm a feminist. You got to understand, I'm like your worst nightmare. I'm like the black Murphy Brown. And my feminist friends were like, "Connie, what are you doing hanging out with all these macho, misogynist men? Because it's not exactly a great place for feminists. You know, the ghetto is not a great place for feminists." And I said, "Look, here's the deal. You and I as women, if we face somebody really stupid enough to discriminate against women like us," I said, "yeah, we might face discrimination. And I might face compound race and sex discrimination. But you want to know something? We've never been a victim of anything because we can sue the hell out of anybody. And anybody who's dumb enough to discriminate against us, they're not going to recover. You and I both know that." I said, "But these men, even with their guns, even with their macho credo that they feel keeps them alive, they're facing annihilation. Because they know they're going to be dead before they're 30. They know that society is going to target them because they're violent, and they have decided violence is the only defense they have against a police force that was viciously aggressive against poor black men in particular. These are men who look at the world and say, 'I'm not long for this place. I ain't going to be here very long. And the only way I can get respect, the only way that I can survive, is to be meaner than the meanest pit bull in this neighborhood. And I got to be able to show people that if they come after me and mine, they will die.' It's a very Darwinian survival culture. And if they were to act the way I act in court, they'd be dead. So, and if I and in their world, their mores and values and ways of being and their cultural cues, their ways get them killed everywhere, in prison, on the streets, in middle-class neighborhoods where they're not supposed to be. My mores will get me killed in their area because their area is so hard to survive in. I don't have the survival skills to survive where they are. And the point of my book is that children should not be trapped in a zone like that. Children shouldn't live anywhere in the United States and have to worry about whether they're going to get a bullet So that's what this book is about. It's about the community, the work I've had the privilege of doing in communities like this, and what I learned from the human beings who survive every day. I mean, most people in these neighborhoods, whether they're kill zones or just very poor areas, they get up every day and they go to work, probably to 2 and 3 jobs if they can find them. And they have to leave their kids to the streets because they can't afford daycare. And we're leaving our kids to the gangs as our daycare system out here in L.A. And I write about what that's going to mean to the rest of us. Because clearly, most of us don't care. We're fine as long as our families are fine. It's okay if there's some people over there. We'll watch what happens to them in a movie, in Menace to Society or some movie, and we'll get entertained by it. But we're not really going to force the political change and the structural change that it's going to take to bring these kids out of the danger zones. Because we have to fundamentally change our priorities in order for safety. The first civil right of all civil rights is the right to be safe. We don't even extend to them the first civil right. But to do that, we're going to have to change how we deliver public goods like safety. We're going to have to change our policies. We can't be building bullet trains before kids stop catching bullets. And we're going to have to change our funding priorities. We're going to change our policing policies, which we are working on. And that is the other part of this story, which is my journey with LAPD.
Talk a little bit about that, because that has really been one of the fundamental changes in Los Angeles and in this world, that there's been this virtual 180-degree turn as far as the police are concerned.
Yes, there's been a 180-degree turn at the top of the police department. I'm not going to say that the old guard sergeant in the back of the squad room who puts thumbs down on all these changes, I'm not going to say he's changed. And for the people in the gang zones, they will tell you, I don't know what this lady's talking about. What do you mean the police have changed? A lot of the cops that you see in the graveyard shift, they understand change is coming, but can I say they've changed? No, not yet. But at the top of LAPD, ever since Chief Bratton came out here 10 years ago, when we were reeling from the Rampart scandal, we had that 10 years between the Rodney King beating and the riots in 92, to the Rampart gangster cop scandal, where we found a gang unit was planting evidence on people, had shot people, had possibly murdered people. They were an out-of-control, running amok in the Rampart area, which is the Pico Union area, a very dense Central American and Central American immigrant community. And in that 10 years began the beginning of the end of the old imperial culture of the Los Angeles Police Department. Now, everybody's heard of LAPD, but maybe not all your listeners have lived under LAPD. They were a super disciplined paramilitary police force, but they were also very, very brutal, and they used force at the drop of a hat. And their credo was, we're going to do what it takes to keep good communities safe. And so the communities I'm talking about were not considered part of the people they protected. It was part of the people they targeted, and they terrorized, especially African American men. They proned everybody out after they stopped you. They stopped everybody without probable cause. If you were in the black community, you were a target of LAPD. And so that's when we were suing them. We sued them in 12 major class actions and dozens of individual cases within those class actions. And so we were at war with LAPD. And I think things began to change when Chief Bratton came out here after the Rampart scandal. Finally, the blue ribbon elites who protected LAPD and kept paying out judgments for the brutality cases they would lose. Once the blue ribbon elite decided that LAPD had gone too far, and Warren Christopher wrote the Christopher Commission report, which said, this police force is racist, and it is brutal, and it must change. It must change from paramilitary policing and occupying territory policing to a community-friendly community policing, which is 180 degrees. If you fast forward, when Bratton came here, he sent me on a journey. He said, Connie, I want to know if I've learned everything from the Rampart scandal. And I'm going to give you subpoena power, and I'm going to give you a whole bunch of other stuff that nobody wants you to have. And I want you to do an investigation. Well, this was 5 years after the Rampart scandal, and I told the chief, I said, you want to know something? We can't do any investigation now. I said, the city didn't want to know what happened, and you're never going to know how far the scandal went because it was buried. I said, but what I'll do is I'll go talk to your cops and learn what we didn't learn from them. And I got to go on this 18-month talking tour with cops, and I got the most amazing testimony. If I had been in a trial for 10 years, I'd have never gotten cops to say the stuff that they said to me in these therapy sessions is what they ended up being. And I learned to talk to them in groups, because if they can hear what everybody else is saying, they'll be honest. If you put them in a room by themselves, they feel like they're snitching on their fellow buddies, and they won't tell you a thing. But in these roundtable discussions, cops would tell me things like, because I'd ask them, you know, why do you guys lie? And they said, look, we tell lie after lie after lie to survive. We're told by politicians to do something we can't do. And if you give cops a mission impossible, we'll break all the rules to make it happen. One cop said, you know what, I plant evidence on people because they don't count and because I have to make my quota. You would never have gotten a cop to say that. So I got this 3D picture of a part of the police mindset. And what they were begging me for was, they said, lady, change things so we don't have to be this way. We're scared. We're afraid we're not going to make it home from our shifts because the community hates us. And so we band together and we're at war with the community. Can you help us change that? We want to protect people here, but we're not given the resources to do it, and so we target them. So when I interviewed Captain Beck, then Captain Beck, he's now the chief of police of LAPD, but at the time he was captain of Rampart, and he said, Connie, I'm glad you're doing this. And I said, who are you, and what did you do with the old Charlie Beck? Because Captain Beck used to be a gang officer, just like the Crash. He was a member of Crash, which is one of the hard-edged, we don't talk to anybody, paramilitary forces. And I didn't recognize this new captain. And I said, what happened, Charlie? What made you change? And this is what he said, quote, search and destroy was no longer working. In fact, it was destroying us, unquote.
Connie Rice, her memoir is Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America from the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. Connie, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you.